Hello and welcome to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we have an interesting, different, and very exciting show today where I'm bringing on the show Dr. Tina Tran and Dr. Steve Beaudry, two of our fantastic attendings here at Johns Hopkins. And what we're going to do for you is try to take you through an oral board exam stem, part of it, the intra-op portion, in two separate ways. First, Dr. Tran is going to go through it, or I will be the examiner, and I will take her through it with the attempt for her to show you what not to do. So she is going to, she has compiled in her preparation a group of kind of mistakes that she's used to seeing people make when they do oral board practice. And she's going to try to kind of make all those mistakes as we go through this 15-minute segment. And then we'll do a little commentary. We'll point out some of the things that she did that we think ideally one would not do. And then Dr. Beaudry, who heads up our oral board preparation program here, is going to give us a shining example of the ideal way to do this. And he's going to try to show you all of the good techniques that he would ideally use when doing your oral boards. Now, some of you out there listening are not anesthesia residents and therefore aren't going to be taking oral boards, but there's still, it's an interesting case, which you'll hear about in a second, and you may be able to enjoy listening anyway. All right. Dr. Tran, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So let's jump right in. I'm going to read. This is, and just a quick review, the way the oral boards work are that you have two separate questions and two separate sessions. The first session, counterintuitively, is actually an intra-op and then post-op, and then the second session is pre-op, intra-op. That's just how it works in terms of time. And so during your first session, which is intra-op and post-op, you're given a lot of information on your sheet that they give you about the pre-op portion since you won't be doing it. Session two, again, is pre-op, intra-op. And so all you get for session two is a short little stem, and that's what we're doing here, an example of session two. So we'll read the short little stem, and that's all you'll be given when you show up for session two. And with that short little stem, they'll then start asking you pre-op questions. We're not going to do the pre-op portion. We're going to go then to what would be next, which is the intra-op portion. The pre-op portion, which we're skipping, you have 10 minutes for. The intra-op portion, you have 15 minutes for. And then on both session one and session two, there's a grab bag. Those are additional topics for 10 minutes. They can throw anything at you. So that's the structure of oral boards. Again, what we're doing today is the intra-op portion. That's a 15-minute portion from a session two STEM question. All right, so the little blurb that you will get and that we are operating off is this. You have a 30-year-old, 110-kilogram, 5-foot, 7-inch woman who's scheduled for a repeat C-section at term pregnancy. Her history includes asymmetric septal hypertrophy, known as IHSS, and mental depression. And by that, they mean clinical depression. Medications include propranolol and amitriptyline. Chest X-ray and EKG demonstrate left ventricular hypertrophy. Her pulse is 64. Her blood pressure is 130 over 85. Her respiratory rate is 18. Her temperature is 37 degrees Celsius, and her hemoglobin is 10.4 grams per deciliter. And that's it. That's what you get. So if Tina were actually taking this in the real oral boards, she would have that stem. She'd have about 10, 15 minutes to sit and take notes on what she thinks are the important things that will be asked of her. And then she'll go into her room. She'll spend 10 minutes getting pre-op questions, and we're skipping that. And now we're going to move right into where she would be for the second 15 minutes, and that's intra-op management. All right. So, Dr. Tran, does this patient require any special monitoring?
I guess I could probably get away with just the standard ASA monitors. I don't really see anything that's really significant about this patient to have me place any other monitors.
Okay. A colleague suggests that you place an arterial catheter and a PA catheter. Do you agree?
I wouldn't necessarily agree. At my institution, we don't really need an arterial catheter or PA catheter. Our OBGYNs are really good surgeons, so they don't really lose a lot of blood, and our patients are always stable. So no, I disagree with my colleague.
So you would not place an arterial line or a PA catheter?
That is correct.
Why might one place a PA catheter in this case?
I guess you could place an arterial catheter if you think there's going to be some hemodynamic instability, if you need to draw frequent arterial catheter blood work, and then for a PA catheter, if you suspect you'll need a lot of resuscitation or if you need pressors to be administered. But honestly, I don't even think that's going to be the case, so I wouldn't even consider it.
All right. How will you induce anesthesia in this patient?
I guess I could do an IV induction. I would give her propofol and succinylcholine.
Why would you do that?
For patients who are pregnant, they usually have a full stomach or assume they have a full stomach. So propofol and succinylcholine provide a rapid onset, and I can do an RSI for the patient.
And why would you want to do an RSI?
Well, like I said, it's because I assume the patients to be full stomach. So I want to get the tube in as quickly as possible.
Okay. How would your choice of approach to induction affect a patient with IHSS or asymmetric septal hypertrophy?
In all honesty, I don't know exactly what that is. I'm assuming it's not going to be any different from a patient who doesn't have a lot of cardiac issues. I'm going to assume that she's otherwise healthy and has been active throughout her pregnancy. So I would not think it affects her in any way. But then again, I don't know what IHSS is.
Okay. So let's say you induce and you attempt to intubate, but you're unable to visualize the larynx at the time of laryngoscopy. What will you do?
So what am I seeing exactly?
You can't see anything. You're looking in the mouth, and you're looking to try to see the cords. You can't see it. All you see is soft tissue.
Do I even see the uvula?
You do see uvula, but that's it.
Can I ventilate for the patient?
So what would you do first when you can't see the larynx?
Well, because I'm trying to do an RSI, I wouldn't try to ventilate for the patient just because I'm afraid that gastric content might come out and obstruct my view of the further of the larynx.
Okay, so you would not attempt to ventilate. What would you do?
I would keep on looking until I see maybe change the patient's position, tilt their head back, open their mouth a little more, change my blade really quickly. But no, I wouldn't really ventilate for this patient.
So now the patient is getting hypoxic. The saturation is 80%. What would you do?
Well, at this point, since there's compromise in the patient's respiratory status and their oxygenation, then at this point I would ventilate for the patient.
So you attempt to do that, and you're having trouble ventilating the patient. The sat continues to drop. What will you do now?
So I would put in an oral airway, a nasal trumpet. I guess I can call someone, but I think I have it under control, but I think I can call another colleague to help me with the ventilation. But yeah, I think usually I can just do it with an oral airway and a nasal trumpet.
So you attempt that. The sat continues to fall. You're still not able to ventilate. The sat is now 60%. What will you do?
So I would, I would try to do a DL, I guess, and then hopefully I can put in the tube. So I would try to see if my colleague has a fiber optic scope, and then I would use that or a glide scope or anything that can assist me, another technique that can assist me.
So let's say you try a variety of techniques and you are now able to ventilate the patient. You attempt a fiber optic assisted intubation. Will you attempt this via the oral or nasal approach?
I would choose the oral because based on my experience and what I've noticed so far is that I can get the tube in more easily in the oral approach.
Are there any advantages or disadvantages to the oral approach compared to the nasal approach?
In terms of nasal for pregnant patients, they can have kind of vascular congestion. So in a pregnant patient, I can easily cause bleeding in the airway if I chose the nasal route, so I would choose the oral approach.
Okay. So suppose instead you choose the nasal route and marked epistaxis occurs. What will you do now?
Am I already in the airway? Have I intubated the patient?
Nope. You've tried to put your fiber through the nose and there's blood everywhere.
Am I able to ventilate for the patient?
How would you know?
Do I see end-tidal CO2?
So you're attempting to mask ventilate?
Okay, so if there is a marked epistaxis, I would put some pressure on the nares that's having the issue, and I would ask a colleague to help me ventilate for the patient orally. I can put in a LMA, and yeah, those are the things I would do.
And what if you can't ventilate?
Then I would call for help, because this is a situation where if I'm not able to oxygenate or ventilate for this patient and she's still pregnant and the OB team hasn't made incision, then I would ask for their assistance to help me at this point possibly doing a surgical airway.
Okay. What is your choice for maintenance of anesthesia in this patient?
Well, I guess you could choose a volatile agent. You could choose Teva. You could choose nitrous. So any of those are okay.
And what would you choose?
I would probably choose an inhaled agent because that's what I'm used to, and the patients usually do fine.
Okay. Are there any disadvantages to inhaled agents?
Sometimes, I guess in the textbooks, they say that it can cause uterine relaxation and contribute to uterine atony, but I haven't seen that, so I wouldn't use volatile.
Would a nitrous oxygen opioid muscle relaxant combination be a good choice?
Yeah, I guess you could. I guess you could do that. Yeah, and then for muscle relaxant, I guess I could use rocky rhodium, because now that a lot of places have Sagamidex, I think that'll be good because I can reverse it if the OBs are quick on in their surgery. So, yeah, that's a good choice.
Are there any disadvantages to that choice?
None that I can see.
If you select a volatile agent for maintenance, would you prefer isoflurane, desflurane, or sevoflurane?
I would prefer isoflurane. It's kind of cheap, and I'm used to using it to titrate anesthetics for OB patients, so I would use isoflurane.
Are there any disadvantages to desflurane or sevoflurane?
If the patient has any kind of airway compromise, such as lower airway issues, desflurane can contribute to bronchospasm. And sevoflurane is a little bit expensive, and it can cause some emergence delirium. So I would not choose those for that reason. But I guess any of them are fine.
Okay. Immediately after delivery of the fetus, the patient's heart rate climbs to 140 beats per minute, and the blood pressure falls to 70 over 40 millimeters of mercury. What do you think is going on?
Oh, I would immediately give this patient phenylephrine, maybe start a phenylephrine drip. I would give open my fluids wide. I would turn down my volatile agents. I would ask the OBs what's happening, because this is a drastic change from what I assumed was a very stable vital signs and stable surgery.
What do you think is going on?
I think possibly there's some bleeding. The OBs are getting into some bleeding, and that's causing her to be hypotensive and tachycardic. But wait, did you say the heart rate goes up first or the blood pressure drops first? Which one happened first?
You noticed them simultaneously.
Okay, then I would need to determine what came first, because if the heart rate came up first, that can possibly, because this patient has IHSS, maybe that cardiac issue is causing the drop in blood pressure. So if that's the case, then I would treat the heart rate and the blood pressure at the same time, actually. So phenylephrine would work in both those situations.
Are there other things on your differential besides bleeding?
It could be pain. It could be light anesthesia. Those are the main things, I guess.
In what way does pain cause hypotension?
Pain doesn't cause hypotension, but it can cause tachycardia, which in this patient's with this patient's heart condition, it possibly could lead to a drop in her blood pressure.
How would you go about figuring out which was the correct diagnosis?
If the patient was bleeding, I would look over the field, and if I see the OB team losing a lot of blood, then I would assume that her heart rate and her blood pressure are the cause of that would be the hypovolemia from brisk blood loss. Other things I would do is just look at my anesthetic, what the medications I recently gave her, kind of look at what the OBs are doing, as well as look at what I'm doing to determine the cause.
And how would you treat?
I would give the patient phenylephrine. I would give the patient fluids and, if needed, blood transfusions.
Okay. The neonate is limp and cyanotic and gasping intermittently with a heart rate of 60 beats per minute. The baby is covered with thick meconium. An associate of yours is able to manage the mother. How will you resuscitate the baby?
Well, the mother is actually my patient and my first priority, so I would not leave the mother at all. I would maybe ask my associate to manage the baby, but I would not leave the mother's side.
If you were the associate, how would you resuscitate the baby?
Let's see. So you said the heart rate was what now?
60.
60. So I guess that's pretty reasonable. I mean, does a patient have a blood pressure?
This is the neonate does not have a blood pressure cuff on. All you know is the heart rate is 60, gasping intermittently and covered in thick meconium.
So I would assist with the baby's breathing because gasping is never a good sign of being able to exchange air very well. So I would ventilate for the baby and also aspirate as much as I can while also calling for the NICU team to arrive as quickly as possible because I haven't done a fellowship or anything in neonatal or pediatric anesthesia, so I would need a lot of help in this case.
The PICU team can't be reached. What are you going to do to assist the airway?
So I would ventilate for the neonate, just try to do some positive pressure or maybe even intubate the neonate if I could.
What is the effect of meconium aspiration?
So I'm not exactly sure, but I'm going to assume it's like a regular aspiration. Let's say this neonate was an adult. I would think that the ability to oxygenate and ventilate the patient is going to be very poor. So I would try to aspirate as much as I can or suction as much as I can to help get the lungs a little bit inflated and get the baby saturation and heart rate up a little more.
How would you suction?
I would suction if I was successfully able to intubate the patient. I would suction through the endotracheal tube, but if not, then I would just suction the oral contents and put down a suction tube as far down as I could.
When is cardiac massage indicated?
Do you mean CPR?
I believe that this very old question is referring to CPR.
Okay, so when is it indicated if I can't feel a pulse? I think this heart rate is a little bit low, so I think at that point I would do resuscitation CPR.
You're saying if you could not feel a pulse?
Correct.
Okay, so you ventilate the patient after suctioning the trachea and placing an endotracheal tube. The heart rate remains at 60 despite ventilation and CPR. What will you do next?
I would give the patient some medication. I think epi is an agent of choice for neonates. It works faster, and this neonate's heart rate of 60 is very, very low, and I think that's can also be contributing to the low blood pressure, possibly poor oxygenation. So I would give epinephrine.
What dose of epinephrine would you give?
I'm not sure in a neonate, but I'm used to resuscitating adults, and usually they get 1 milligram. So I guess anywhere between 0.5 to 1 milligram IV.
All right. So that is the end of the intraoperative management section. That took about 13 or 14 minutes, so we were slightly ahead of time, but that's fine. The key is getting through it all. So now I want to bring Dr. Tran back as herself and ask you what are some things that you did on purpose there that you would recommend residents do not do?
So the things that I've seen myself and other residents do are, they say things such as at my institution or I do it because that's how I'm comfortable and so that's how I'm going to approach the patient. And not really clarifying exactly why from a clinical point or a knowledge-based point on why it's appropriate, the management is appropriate. And other things I try to point out was that if the examiner asks you what would you do, you should say I would rather than you could, I guess, maybe. Mm-hmm. You would give a definitive I would do such and such because such and such. And then other things were to ask a lot of questions of the examiner. If you encounter a situation where the answers are not very clear or the question is not very clear or the details aren't there, you can either ask the examiner to repeat the question or you can assume certain things. And if the examiner has a different script that he or she is following, then he or she will say, actually, the scenario that you assumed is not correct. This is the assumption you should make. So assume if you don't know, but I try to illustrate not that the examinee was asking a lot of questions of the examiner, which is a mistake. And let's see, what else here? And then just things such as not really caring about some of the patient's medical conditions, such as IHSS, and changes in pregnancy can really affect this situation or this diagnosis. So I didn't really delve into why. I didn't state that this is an important thing to know about the patient. I just kind of guessed along as I went and managed it as if this patient didn't have it. I guess I was kind of hoping that it wouldn't really come up in the questions.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing was that when I asked a question about managing, when the examiner asked me about managing the mother, I was really rigid in my answer. I said, well, actually, I would not leave the mother's side under any circumstance. So that was a really rigid answer. So, and you saw in this case that Dr. Walpaw actually said, how would my associate or how would you direct the associate to ask or to manage the mother, which is a very good way of asking, getting me to answer the question if I remained rigid. So those are the key points or the key mistakes I try to point out.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much. I think you did a really great job of kind of doing those while at the same time, you know, you gave reasonable answers to a lot of the questions. So, you know, this is something we could definitely see someone doing. And it isn't even that this was necessarily or definitively a failing example, but there are a lot of these things you pointed out that you could polish up. So things I noticed, and you mentioned some of these, but you said, I guess a lot. You know, I guess I would do this. You said they would do this or they would do that. You said assuming, you talked about the assuming, you did a lot of kind of assuming. You can ask questions, but as you said, you don't want to overdo it. You know, answer based on what you know. Saying what you wouldn't do. So there was a variety of times where instead of saying what you would do, you said a variety of things you would not do. We'll talk after Dr. Beaudry does his example. We can go back and do a little bit of talking about some of the medical facts here just for people's learning. One big hole, obviously, which we can come back to, was not thinking about an LMA and the difficult airway scenario. You said a lot, as I think you pointed out, I would do that because it's what I always do, or I would do that because that's what we do at my institution, right? Those are not good reasons to give on an oral board exam. And then you often didn't answer the question. So if the question was, what do you think is going on? You instead said what you would do. And so that's a key distinction. They'll ask you, what would you do if they want to know what you would do? But if they say, what's your differential or what do you think is going on here? They want you to give them a differential diagnosis, which you did not do. And then there was a lot of, as you pointed out, guessing at the answer. So it's really important if you don't if you don't know something to just say, you know, I don't know, I'd have to look that up. That's a perfectly acceptable thing to say. But guessing and saying, I don't really know, so I think I'd do this, is definitely problematic. Guessing at the dose of epinephrine, for example, is definitely not a good way to go. If you don't know the dose, then you would say, you know, I don't know, I'd look it up. And that's perfectly fine. A lot of us do look up dosing of medications, especially in pediatrics, when it varies based on weight. All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Tran, for highlighting an example of what not to do.
Great. Thank you.
Now I want to bring in Dr. Beaudry. Dr. Beaudry, welcome to the show.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me.
All right. So Dr. Beaudry, as I said, heads up our oral board prep course here, does a fantastic job of it. So no one better to give us the example of what we can do here. So I'm going to just hop right in and take you through it. So remember, let's just review for everybody out there, the stem. So this is a 30-year-old, 110-kilogram, 5'7" woman. She's having a repeat C-section at term pregnancy. Her history includes asymmetric septal hypertrophy, which was used to be known as IHSS, and in the setting of this question was still known as IHSS, and she has mental depression, which they mean clinical depression. Medications include propranolol and amitriptyline. Her chest x-ray and EKG demonstrate left ventricular hypertrophy. Her pulse is 64. Her blood pressure is 130 over 85. Her respiratory rate is 18. Her temperature is 37 degrees Celsius, and her hemoglobin is 10.4 grams per deciliter. All right. So remember, in this scenario, Dr. Beaudry has already been taken through the pre-op portion of this stem for 10 minutes by the examiners, and now we are moving into the intraoperative portion management. So does this patient require any special monitoring?
Yes, I think she does require at least invasive arterial line monitoring, as well as standard ASA monitors.
All right, and what are standard ASA monitors?
Non-invasive blood pressure cuff, continuous pulse oximetry, and if I were to intubate the patient and put her under general anesthesia, then end-tidal capnometry.
Okay. A colleague suggests that you place both an arterial line, which you have said you would, but also a PA catheter. Do you agree?
I don't agree with that for a few reasons. One, the patient is at risk for arrhythmias, and PA catheters can cause significant arrhythmias, which in this case would be life-threatening. And they're not without risk. Risks with line placement, including damage to carotid artery, pneumothorax, tricuspid valve injury, and then, of course, the most catastrophic thing would be pulmonary artery rupture. And I just don't think that the benefits of PA catheter monitoring outweigh the risks.
Okay. How will you induce anesthesia in this patient?
Well, my plan for her would actually be epidural anesthesia for the case. And I'm choosing that because, in general, I'd like to avoid general anesthesia in pregnant patients in general. But also for her, in this particular patient, I want to avoid any dramatic hemodynamic swings. And so I feel like I can really achieve that with a well-controlled epidural anesthetic.
If you were contraindicated from doing an epidural or the patient refused, how would you then induce anesthesia?
So I would plan for a general endotracheal anesthetic. As I said earlier, I'd like an invasive arterial line, which I would try to place pre-induction with local anesthesia. And then I would induce general anesthesia through various medications through the IV. I would plan for a rapid sequence induction as well. Because she's a pregnant patient, we do treat them as a full stomach. And so rapid IV anesthesia with a rapid-acting neuromuscular blocker would be indicated.
You mentioned you would place the arterial line pre-induction. Why would you do that?
My indications for placing it are for hemodynamic monitoring because she is at risk for significant arrhythmias and issues with hemodynamic instability. So because general anesthesia can induce those, I'd want to place that beforehand so I wouldn't have to worry about trying to place it after she's induced, as well as that would delay the time that the longer the time she's under general anesthesia, the more exposure to the fetus, which we try to avoid.
And what are your concerns using general anesthesia, since you said you would try to avoid it? What are your concerns with general anesthesia in a patient with IHSS?
Specifically, in a patient with IHSS, we want to avoid tachycardia. I want to avoid decreasing her preload and volume loading to the heart because of the risk of worsening collapse of the left ventricle. That's really what she's mostly at risk for, is left ventricular outflow obstruction. So, and potent anesthetics can certainly cause that. So if I can avoid that, I would.
Okay. You are unable to visualize the larynx at the time of laryngoscopy. What will you do?
So if I'm performing direct laryngoscopy at this particular juncture, I would try to optimize my view as best I can. I could even have someone who may be assisting already with cricoid pressure try to help bring the larynx into direct view, optimizing head position, perhaps putting another shoulder roll underneath, all while still maintaining whatever view I do have. I would try to optimize all those things first on my first attempt, but if that is not successful, then whatever I'm diagnosing, whether I think her airway is anterior, perhaps I'd come out and then try perhaps a video laryngoscopy approach with an angulated blade to try to get a better view of an anterior airway.
You're having difficulty ventilating the patient, and the saturation has fallen to 80%. What will you do?
So I would try to optimize ventilation by placing an oral airway if it seems like she's having upper airway obstruction. Possibly a two-person mask ventilation technique would be helpful. But I would want to – we really would not tolerate letting her oxygen saturation continue to fall. So I would really try to optimize those things as quick as possible and then make transition to possibly a LMA, laryngeal mask airway, as a bridge to securing the airway leader.
Okay, you are successful in being able to ventilate the patient with your attempts, and you decide to attempt a fiber optic assisted intubation. Will you select an oral or nasal approach?
Ideally, I'd choose an oral approach, because primarily if the patient's asleep, she would likely tolerate an oral approach. Plus, avoiding the nasal passage, which can be pretty friable and edematous in a pregnant patient, is ideal. I really don't want to cause any significant nosebleed, which could really render the fiber optic kind of useless. So if possible, I would choose an oral approach.
Are there any advantages to the nasal approach?
I believe it's a shorter route and a little more direct to the glottis coming through the nose. But again, if she's asleep and would tolerate an oral approach, I think that'd be best in this situation.
All right. You do, in fact, choose a nasal approach, and you encounter marked epistaxis. What will you do now?
So this could seriously compromise our view of the using the fiber optic scope. So I would abandon that technique. Applying pressure may be helpful, but I would just try to secure the airway through the oral approach as quickly as possible, whether that's through, again, a video laryngoscope, or even an LMA, and then assisted intubation through the LMA. So I'd proceed.
Great. What is your choice for maintenance of anesthesia?
There are several different things we could choose. I would choose a volatile-based anesthetic.
And why would you choose that?
One concern is that maintaining or minimizing the chance of awareness that is a high risk in pregnancy in pregnant patients having surgery. It's also rapidly titratable. So if there is any issues with hemodynamic instability, I could rapidly titrate. As well as it is a potent uterine relaxant, which can assist with delivery of the infant.
Would a nitrous, oxygen, opioid, muscle relaxant combination be a good choice?
I think it's a reasonable choice. However, it wouldn't be my primary choice. Again, I'd prefer to avoid nitrous before the infant is out in order to optimize oxygenation, as well as there's not a lot of reassurance that I'm going to be able to keep her totally amnestic with that. However, once the infant is out, I would switch to a nitrous and opioid muscle relaxant technique to minimize uterine atony and try to minimize the volatile anesthetics after the infant's delivered.
If you select a volatile anesthetic, which you did, would you prefer isoflurane, desflurane, or sevoflurane?
I think they're all reasonable choices. My primary preference would be sevoflurane.
Why?
I think it's a good balance between being a rapid-acting anesthetic, but also it can come off quickly. Because I do want her to wake up relatively fast at the end. And you know, given her body habitus, I don't want to prolong her emergence with a really fat-soluble anesthetic like isoflurane. Sevoflurane is also a potent bronchodilator, which even though she doesn't have any history of hyperreactive airway disease, it still may help minimize any airway irritation possibly from desflurane. So that would be my choice.
Immediately after delivery of the fetus, the patient's heart rate climbs to 140 beats per minute and the blood pressure falls to 70 over 40 millimeters of mercury. What do you think is going on?
Well, there are several things in my differential at this point, and I would try to simultaneously diagnose what's going on and treat. So the first thing I would like to do is look at the monitors and see what exactly her heart rate or, excuse me, her rhythm is and try to rule out a malignant arrhythmia versus possibly just sinus tachycardia from multiple causes. It could be hypovolemia from bleeding. She could have other hypoxia causing arrhythmias. So I would initially start with that global assessment.
Okay. How would you differentiate what might be going on?
So looking at the whole picture, I'd look at the field to try to determine if there's significant blood loss. I'd certainly be communicating with the obstetricians about uterine tone. If she has ongoing poor uterine tone and blood loss, that could certainly cause hypotension and tachycardia. Other things that are more, I think, life-threatening as well would be, again, malignant arrhythmias, possibly from hypoxia or hypercarbia. I'd want to know if this was a regular or an irregular rhythm, which would determine my approach. And based on those things, I would start to treat as well. If I thought she was hypovolemic from bleeding, I'd open up her IV fluids, start titrating in vasopressors. I may have to cut back on the anesthetic and make sure that she's not too anesthetized, causing myocardial depression. And if she looked like she had significant bleeding, I think a blood transfusion may be indicated as well.
The neonate is limp and cyanotic, gasping intermittently with a heart rate of 60 beats per minute and covered with thick meconium. An associate is able to manage the mother. How will you resuscitate the baby?
So once I ensure that the mother's stable and is still within my proximity to manage, I would help assist the resuscitation of the baby. I'd first call over whoever else is available to help, and that could be an obstetrician or another nurse who's trained in neonatal resuscitation. I would prioritize oxygenation, which is typically the main issue with a depressed neonate. I would likely apply oxygen through a mask, either through continuous either blow-by or even CPAP, to assist the ventilation of the infant. But knowing that now the patient also has, or that the infant has thick meconium, may be reasonable to try to clear that out of the airway first before any positive pressure ventilation takes place.
What are the effects of meconium aspiration?
I believe there, is a possibility for hypoxia just from being unable to move air through the airways. There may also be ARDS-like inflammatory picture later on. I don't know how soon that occurs, but certainly getting just the physical meconium out of the airway in order to allow oxygen exchange would be my priority.
When is cardiac massage or CPR indicated?
I believe in the neonate, once the airway has been, or the oxygenation and ventilation has been ensured, if bradycardia below 60 or below continues to occur, then chest compressions are indicated at that point.
You ventilate the patient after suctioning the trachea and placing an endotracheal tube. The heart rate remains at 60 despite ventilation and CPR. What will you do next?
I believe at this point drug therapy is indicated. I don't believe we would likely have an IV in the patient at this point, so either IM or IO administration would be needed. So epinephrine would be my initial resuscitation drug of choice.
And what dose would you give?
I actually don't recall the dose at this point. I would certainly consult my colleagues, and if there a lot of times there are neonatal resuscitation cards available in the NICU or in the warmer. So I would consult that first before giving a medication.
Great. And that takes us, again, to the end of the intraoperative management portion. Thank you, Dr. Beaudry.
Thank you very much.
So let's now go back, and why don't you point out some of the things you tried to do that you think are best practices for residents as they prepare for their oral boards?
Well, in general, I think it's very important to answer the question that you've been asked. And people have different ways of approaching this and different advice given to residents, but you definitely want to answer the question. But I do think it's okay to give some background as well, because clearly, as you did, if I didn't give you the background, you came back later and asked for it. So if I can anticipate that you're going to want more background, I think it's reasonable to give some ahead of time and sort of justify my decision based on that. So certainly answering the question, and if you realize you haven't answered the question, you can certainly come back and say you realize you've talked about a lot of different things, but ultimately you do have to come back and say, so I would give sevoflurane, mm-hmm. or I would give epinephrine.
Absolutely. Other things do you think are important?
I think avoiding asking questions as far as there's a way to ask questions without asking questions directly. And one way I've tried to approach that is I say, well, if it looks like the heart rate, the EKG rhythm is a malignant arrhythmia, I would want to treat that. However, if it looks like sinus tachycardia with hypotension, I would likely treat it as such with volume administration or pressors. So in that way, I'm not asking if she's having an arrhythmia, but I'm sort of saying if the possibility exists, at least you know that I'm thinking about it.
I think that's exactly right. That is a perfect way. If you're not sure, you're letting them know what you're assuming without even saying the words "I'm assuming," and at the same time, you're demonstrating that you know how to deal with this if that is indeed what it is. And you open up; they can, of course, always say, "No, that's the you see that it's not a malignant rhythm. You see that it's sinus tachycardia, and make you deal with that if they want to do that." So I think that's exactly right.
And the other thing, you got me on the drug dose for epinephrine, which I did not recall. And I think it's always a good idea to just stop and say what you would normally do in real life, because this should reflect your everyday practices. And you would never give a drug that you were not familiar with how much to give and how to give it. So it's very, very reasonable to say I would stop and consult my colleagues, or I'd consult any resource that you have before administering any drug. So even if you don't know, don't make it up. Tell them what you would normally do, which would be to consult another resource.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I think that you're way better off saying, I don't know, I'd have to look it up, than guessing or making something up. That's going to get you in a lot more trouble. So great. So other things I saw that I thought were really good, you repeatedly referred back to the patient and patient factors. So you said in the setting of this patient with HOCM or with IHSS, she's at risk for arrhythmias given her heart disease. So that shows that you're not just giving rote answers, you're thinking about this specific patient, and that's going to really impress. You mentioned not only you didn't kind of fall for the how would you induce anesthesia. You took a step back and said, you know, I wouldn't induce general anesthesia, I would do an epidural. And that they can try to trap you in that. They can give you a scenario where you would never induce anesthesia. They give you a patient with a K of 7 and say, how would you induce? And the answer would be, I would not induce. I wouldn't even take this patient to the operating room until we dealt with this. So you caught that. You picked up on it. And then you didn't just say you would do an epidural, but you gave your reasons why, and they were very solid. You mentioned the advantages to the nasal approach and to the oral approach. So you had that. You chose what you would say. And then when I pushed you a little bit and said, you know, why, what would be the advantage of the other way, you were able to do that. Instead of just saying, well, it's kind of what I like to do or what I always do. Again, you referred back to the patient. You mentioned, you know, given her body habitus, I would keep this in mind and that in mind. So again, showing that you're thinking about this specific patient. You mentioned a couple times, you know, I'd look at the monitors and see what else was going on. So that's crucial. And I always emphasize to residents, when they give you something like hypotension, tachycardia, hypoxia, whatever it is, you've got to look at your monitors both to know that you're paying attention to what else could be happening with this patient. Is everything crashing or is it just one system? And also because, as you mentioned, it's going to help you with your differential. If the patient's hypotensive and tachycardic and you look at your EKG strip and they're in AFib with RVR, that's going to help you know what's going on as opposed to sinus tachycardia. So always, always have that reflexive, I would look at my monitors and see what else, see what the vitals look like, make sure the other vitals were stable. Calling for help is essential. You're almost always on oral boards, I think never going to get help when you call for it, but always key to know that you would call for it. And then you mentioned the epi thing. So really nice job. Dr. Tran, anything you noticed that you want to point out that Dr. Beaudry did well?
No, I thought he answered the questions very well. And things that I would, in addition to answering the questions correctly like he did, and for people who are listening to the podcast, he looked directly at Dr. Walpaw when he answered the questions. He sat up nice and straight and didn't do any fidgeting. And it was just a good communication, nonverbal communication that he did, which is also very key in passing the oral boards.
Yeah, I agree with Tina's comments. You know, ideally, this, you know, 2 points really. I think, again, we want to emphasize this should reflect your everyday practices. And so, taking a step back to what you mentioned about the monitors, that's something that we just do intuitively. And you don't know you're doing it until you stop and you do this practice. But if you don't say on the exam, you're not going to make it clear that you would do that. But really, it should be everything that you normally do in your everyday practice. If you hear the saturation monitor declining, you always look up. It's just a reflex, but you have to verbalize that. And to what Tina was saying, this should be a conversation. Even though it's an exam, I think if you keep it more conversational, things tend to flow a bit better and you're more confident in your answers as opposed to feeling like you're just trying to answer the question and move on. It really should be a conversation. And I think the examiners probably prefer that too.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think you point out some really key things. Tina, you pointed out the eye contact and all of that, which is really essential. And then Steve, the idea of really thinking of it as a conversation and doing what you would do. And it's why I actually love this, even for CA1. So some people say, well, you know, CA1 shouldn't be doing oral board practice. But I disagree. I think that the advantage of doing this is not to put a lot of pressure on a CA1 that you have to be able to ace these questions, but it makes you start thinking about what you're doing in the operating room instead of just doing it automatically without really thinking about it. So it's actually a pretty good way to structure learning, and I know you're working on that here, and it's really a fantastic curriculum that you're working on. So let's just go through briefly and see, are there any kind of key learning points just from the kind of topic that we want to point out? One that I mentioned before is that the difficult airway algorithm would say that when you enter that cannot intubate, cannot ventilate situation, your first step in terms of trying to save yourself, as you said, Steve, when you were doing your go-through, is to put an LMA. And so if you can't intubate, you can't ventilate, and you've tried, you know, you've tried two-hand ventilation and all that, but if you still can't intubate, you can't ventilate, then you're going to put an LMA in. If that works, you're no longer in an emergency. If it doesn't work, now you're truly in the emergency pathway where you are going to go down towards trying something else. But if that doesn't work, something else meaning like video laryngoscopy or fiber optic, but if that doesn't work, you're heading toward a surgical airway. Any other thoughts on that or any other kind of learning points you guys want to point out?
No, and I've seen it come up where, you know, ventilating, mask ventilating, or even placing an LMA in a pregnant patient, you know, that question has thrown off residents because they have been taught not to ventilate a pregnant patient because of the risk of aspiration. But it's important to emphasize in your mind when you're taking this exam, you have to think of, you know, what's most dangerous to this patient. And, you know, a saturation of 80% in her, given her cardiovascular disease, is more likely going to cause harm than the potential risk for aspiration. So I try to emphasize when I'm debriefing with the residents that there's going to be bad and worse, and you just have to pick the one that's less bad. And so do what you have to do to save her life. And if but there's always the possibility of aspiration, but you can manage that. And sometimes it's sort of a revelation to them that they will have to do something that they're not comfortable with, and that's really, again, reflects real life.
Absolutely. So I totally agree. Similarly, or other things that I think, you know, we could mention here. So IHSS, now more commonly known as HOCM, but the management for that, as you said during your go-through here, you really want to focus on keeping people full. You want that left ventricle full. And so ways to get that are increasing afterload, reducing or avoiding tachycardia, and reducing contractility. So you don't want to give a pressor like epinephrine or norepinephrine if you don't have to, which would increase contractility and heart rate. Phenylephrine is a great drug here. It's going to, if anything, cause reduced heart rate. It's going to cause an increase in afterload, and it does not have any beta action, so it's not going to cause increased contractility. So it's kind of the perfect pressor for these patients. Any other thoughts on HOCM?
I think, you know, general versus regional anesthesia always comes up for pregnant patients with cardiovascular disease, and there's no right or wrong answer as again in life in anesthesia practice. But I think the majority, my gut feeling is that most people would probably induce general anesthesia because we feel like you can control things a bit better. You can put in invasive lines, and you can monitor, or you can control hemodynamics a little bit better, but realize that provided there's no other contraindication to regional anesthesia, it is a decent option for this case. I would avoid single-shot spinal anesthesia or even combined spinal epidural anesthesia because of the risk for dramatic hypotension, tachycardia. That would really be life-threatening. But the flip side would be a slowly controlled epidural anesthetic, especially if she was in this situation, she's a bit obese, potentially challenging airway, and if you don't want to even deal with that, I think it's certainly a reasonable choice.
I completely agree. And what I love is that, you know, it's a good learning point for oral boards. You should be able to justify your choice. There's almost never a 100% wrong choice. There are sometimes, obviously, if a patient's K was 7 and you said you'd use sucks, that would be wrong. But in the setting of most of these things, you can pick epidural, you can pick GA. Either one would have been fine for this case as long as you can justify it. And so that's the key, is they're going to call you out. They're going to challenge you. They're going to push you a little bit. Why would you do that? Why not this? But that's okay, as long as you can justify it. You don't have to say there's not a right answer per se, as much as it is they want to hear your reasoning. All right. Dr. Tran, Dr. Beaudry, anything else you think we should highlight here before we wrap?
Well, I think in regard to just practicing for the oral boards, there's a couple of things that I like to recommend. One is, you know, if you have the opportunity when you're pre-oping with your attending the night before, just to throw out some scenarios about, you know, what else could we do or what could we do differently for this case, even if you're going to do it the same way every time. If, let's say, there's a particular case that you've done 100 times and you always do GA and you always use isoflurane and an arterial line, it is fun to think about how else could we do this? And you can even do that on your own. So even the next day during the case, you can think about perhaps it's a knee replacement. And even though you've put them to sleep, just like every other time, you think, well, what else could I do? If I was going to do a spinal anesthetic, what would I use? How would I dose it? What level do I need? Are there any contraindications to that? And because it does get you to think outside of your typical everyday practice and your experience as a resident. And it would be expected on the exam that you'd have some knowledge of other ways of doing a case. So like for this case in particular, again, even though most people would likely do general anesthesia, you know, is regional anesthesia even an option? And so it is a good exercise to go through and get used to that, even if you would never do something different.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what residency or training of any kind is for, is to really think through and practice and use your skills and knowledge and push yourself. Don't fall into that kind of, you know, trap of being able to just cruise because you know how to do a few things. You really want to be in a situation where you're practicing stuff so that when you're out there on your own, you're ready to go. So I totally agree with you. All right, Dr. Tran, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Great. Thank you for having me. I hope it's beneficial for everyone, to all our residents, and help them have a successful oral board session.
And Dr. Beaudry, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It was an absolute pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks to both of you. I really hope we can do another one again soon. So that is it for today. Thanks for listening. Remember, you can check out this and every episode at acrac.com. That's ACCRAC.com, where you can also leave comments. So for this episode, let us know, was this helpful? How do you practice for oral boards? Remember, the comments you leave are not just for us, but also, of course, for everyone else. So you may have some tips on how to study for oral boards that will help other people out there. Let us know what you thought of the episode. If you have any particular tidbits or recommendations based on this particular stem. Maybe you would manage a patient with HOCM who is pregnant differently. Let us know. We can all learn from each other's knowledge. You can also, of course, reach me, acrac@acrac.com. And on the website, you can join the mailing list in the upper right-hand corner where you can click and enter your email address, and then you'll get notifications anytime there's a new episode and any other interesting facts that I send around. If you are enjoying the podcast and you're a regular listener, please do me a favor. Go to iTunes, find the podcast, and leave a rating and a comment. It helps other people find the show. All right, that's it for today. For Dr. Stephen Beaudry and Dr. Tina Tran, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.